Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney. I'm pleased to be hosting you for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world with some of the best in the business, one of whom is our guest in this first segment, Richard Miniter. Rich, as he's known to his friends, is one of our country's most intrepid and capable investigative journalists. He's also been an editor, an author, a talk radio show host. He's a man, in short, of many parts. But the one that is particularly valuable to us at the moment is he is the author of a brand new book entitled Mastermind, that is a biography of a fellow who we're going to spend a fair amount of the show talking about, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the self-declared architect of the 9/11 attacks, and, as it turns out, much, much more. Rich, welcome. It's great to have you with us, especially in the immediate aftermath of the spectacle that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his friends affected over the weekend. First of all, give us a little bit of a précis, if you would, of what you found, perhaps to your surprise, and I'm sure to ours, about this guy, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, or KSM as he's known.
Well, Frank, great to be with you. Yeah, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is responsible for the deaths of more than 3,000 Americans, both on the morning of September 11th in New York, Pennsylvania, and Washington, but also he's been involved in every major al-Qaeda attack in the history of that organization, from the 1998 embassy bombings, which killed 224 people, including 12 American diplomats, the attack on the USS Cole, which killed or injured 44 American sailors, and for the first time since the end of World War II, almost sank a U.S. warship. He's also responsible for the Bali bombing, which killed 202 people, involved in some of the funding and planning of the Madrid bombings, which killed another 200 people. And then he had a number of plots that he failed to carry out that were, you know, more devastating than that, dreamed up by a James Bond villain. I mean, he had two attempts to kill Pope John Paul II, a plot to kill President Jimmy Carter, a separate plot to kill President Bill Clinton, and, of course, he had plots on to blow up the Panama Canal, the Empire State Building in New York City, the Lincoln and Holland Tunnels in that city, the Chicago Sears Tower, the Library Tower in Los Angeles, the Space Needle in Seattle, as well as attacks overseas, including the a plan to blow up Heathrow Airport and the Big Ben Clock Tower outside of Parliament. So this is a guy who has killed thousands of people and wanted to kill thousands more, and is a diehard Islamic terrorist.
Right. Rich, just drill down on that. What is it that motivates a guy to want to do this kind of really horrific destruction to the United States of America? You mentioned he's a diehard Islamic terrorist, but what impels him?
Well, he was recruited into the Muslim Brotherhood at age 16 in Kuwait, and there learned the radical Salafi ideology, of which al-Qaeda is a part, the Muslim Brotherhood is a part, the radical Saudis are a part of this larger Salafi movement. And they believe in single world domination under an Islamic dictator called a caliph, and in which everyone, Muslims and non-Muslims, are forced to obey Sharia law, which, as you know, makes almost impossible for a woman to testify against a man in court, in which women and non-Muslims have fewer legal rights. For example, a Christian can never testify against a more Muslim in court.
If they have any rights at all, indeed, Jews and homosexuals and apostates and some women simply don't, for that matter. This is really a critical point, Rich Miniter, as you say it so well. This is a guy who is acting on the same fundamental belief system, doctrine, ideology, whatever you want to call it, as people were endlessly told are nonviolent, the Muslim Brotherhood, and yet have the same purpose and are perfectly prepared to use violence when the opportunity presents itself. To the extent...
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood is like a gateway drug, right? I mean, every heroin user starts out using marijuana. The Muslim Brotherhood is the gateway into radical Muslim thought for virtually every major Islamic terrorist group. Everyone spends at least some time in the Brotherhood, in the Iqwan, as it's known in Arabic. And certainly that's true of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, or KSM, as his Guantanamo guards call him.
Right. And to the extent that this guy was and is a danger, what is the thought about prosecuting him in court? We're going to have a conversation shortly with Andy McCarthy, and he ruminated with me about the fact that you don't want to let a guy like this go. Is there any risk that that could eventuate, Rich, given what you know about the guy, given what the federal government knows about him, and given the nature of the prosecution that is before us now?
Well, first, a little context. Since the mid-1960s, the anti-war radical left wanted to turn warfare into a criminal matter. They wanted to basically put America's enemies in courts and give them all the rights of defendants. That was laughed at of court in the 60s and 70s, but it came back in the war on terror as an anti-Bush measure, and it's something that Obama campaigned on. When Eric Holder was made attorney general by President Obama and confirmed by the Senate, he immediately canceled the trial that had been underway in 2008 with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. So that more than a year and a half of pretrial work was thrown out, and the trial, which was days away from beginning, was stopped. Now, this Saturday, just a few days ago, we're now back to the beginning. We're back to the pretrial motions. The arraignment that occurred on Saturday with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four other defendants, typically in a U.S. criminal court, an arraignment lasts less than 10 minutes, even with multiple defendants. In this case, it lasted more than 13 hours. And that's because the lawyers who were defending these guys, at U.S. taxpayer expense, by the way, spent hours and hours cross-examining the judge, asking him, sir, do you belong to any clubs or organizations? To which the judge very dryly replied, just the United States Army. And where they were trying to just basically to get him to disqualify himself and start the process over, where we'd need to appoint yet another judge. They believe in jihad in the courtroom. They use the legal system against us the same way as on 9/11 they use our planes against us. Anything that we set up, they want to subvert and use against us. And of course, the 9/11 family victims are watching, and they notice that this case has been delayed for years. And the 13 hours of these shenanigans really enabled Al-Qaeda to victimize them one more time.
All over again. We're speaking with Richard Miniter. He is the author most recently of the new book, Mastermind, The Many Faces of the 9/11 Architect, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Rich, I guess that's a point I wanted to address with you, the games, the antics of these so-called defense lawyers. Including one in which a non-Muslim female dressed herself up in a strict Sharia-adherent Muslim garb and demanded that every other woman in the courtroom be similarly veiled and masked. This really speaks so powerfully to the point you just made, that we're dealing with people who are indeed engaged in a kind of... stealthy or civilization jihad, as the Brotherhood calls it, that it corresponds to and is aimed at pursuing exactly the same ends as the violence of guys like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. How do we defend ourselves against that threat, in your estimation, Rich Miniter?
Well, first of all, we need stronger judges. I mean, when this woman, a lawyer, made an argument that women in the courtroom should all have to cover themselves, including, by the way, women in American military uniforms, and of course the hijab is not part of a U.S. military uniform. When you are in uniform, you are required to wear what the uniform requires, no more and no less. And so to ask the military to change its rules and for these women to cover their faces and hair in order to make the four terrorists happy is simply unbelievable. And the female reporters in the room, was heard audibly saying, "Oh my God," when it looked as if that they were judge was about to order them all to be covered. Look, the
the judge needs to take a stronger hand here. He should never have let this go on for 13 hours. You can't play Judge Lancito in the O.J. Simpson case here. The judge needs to take a stronger hand and say, no, this is an American courtroom applying American law, and everyone is equal before the law, and Sharia law simply doesn't apply here.
Doesn't apply. Amen. Rich Minderter, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but I'm looking forward to many more visits with you about this book, about your study of this man and the movement of which he is a part, particularly that stealthy jihadist element and what we have to do about it. The subject, by the way, of our new course at MuslimBrotherhoodInAmerica.com. I hope you'll check it out, folks. Next up, we'll be speaking with Michael Corrin about 10 lies they spread about Christianity. Straight ahead.
First line of defense in the war of ideas, Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of 3 children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a 5th grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a 5-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Congress doesn't have a budget for 2011, but the GOP has proposed a budget for 2012, and Bill Bennett likes it.
Maybe it helps to have that 2012 in the background, people hearing and seeing Ryan and the Republicans saying we're serious about really cutting the budget
as a backdrop
to this debate about 2011. People make the decision, well, Republicans seem much more serious about this.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Michael Corrin. He is the host of The Arena, a man like our previous guest, Rich Minderter, of many parts, a host of television, radio, a syndicated columnist, an author, and a highly sought-after speaker. And we have sought him out here for a conversation about a new book. And Michael, let me set up the subject, if I may, by tying it into something that we found in a course, as we call it, that we've recently produced at the Center for Security Policy on the Muslim Brotherhood in America. And one of the things that jumps out at you in particular in connection with the extraordinary success the Brotherhood and its friends and allies have had in insinuating their program inside our country, inside our civil society institutions, inside our government, for that matter, is the, well, special treatment that they have received, treatment unimaginable for followers of other faith traditions, notably Christians. And this brings us to the subject of your new book, Heresy, 10 Lies They Spread About Christianity. And give us a flavor of just how really differently. The traditions of this country, the Judeo-Christian traditions of this country, are now being treated relative to, well, Islam, for example.
By the way, that was a terrific piece of work you did on the Brotherhood. I mean, that's I think that's been sent to me now by about 15 different people. So you have to see this. It's remarkable. And it is, because, and it's not just the U.S., of course. It's the entire Western world. I'll give you an example. Breivik, this mass murderer in Norway. Here is a man who was a Freemason. He said in his manifesto he hadn't been to church in 17 years. He had no personal relationship with Christ. He supported same-sex marriage and abortion rights. He quoted many atheist philosophers. So from all of this, you can see he wasn't really much of a Christian. However, as soon as the attack was committed and he was known, he was referred to as a Christian fundamentalist. Even now, so long after, with the trial taking place, he's still referred to as a Christian. He wasn't a Christian, but because I suppose he wasn't Muslim, they describe him thus. Timothy McVeigh, someone who said, science is my religion, who was an atheist, again, referred to as a Christian. Now, contrast this with every time there's a jihadist attack, and there have been almost 20,000 now since 9/11, and I get very annoyed when North Americans say, no, that's not true, but we don't recall the last one. No, you don't, because they didn't occur in North America. There have been some. Most of the victims of jihadism are other Muslims, and how ironically racist these people aren't aware of them. But every time this occurs, every euphemism you can imagine is used to twist and turn away from describing the attack as Muslim or Islamic. And apart from anything else, it's terribly rude to these murdering scum because, of course, they claim they are. They say this is in the name of Islam. They quote the Quran. They say we are doing this as Muslims. They couldn't be more explicit about it. Yet we say in media, well, they say in media, no, it has nothing to do with religion. Or it's fundamentalism, and all fundamentalist interpretations produce this. Well, the next time a fundamentalist Mennonite or a fundamentalist Quaker tries to cut my head off, maybe I'll agree with them. No, there's a terrible double standard. And the BBC, from my country of origin, they even have a policy, and many other networks have copied this in North America, where you can't actually call something Islamic. You have to use some other word, and people have been reprimanded, even fired, for saying it's an Islamic terror attack. So it's a gross double standard.
And of course, Michael Corrin, if I may just quickly, you, of course, hail from Canada. And several of your countrymen, one now, we're happy to say, living in the United States, Mark Stein, Ezra Levant, the other, having been prosecuted in Canada for offenses of the kind you've just described, make it much more than simply, you know, a matter of being politically incorrect or self-censorship. It's actually become a punishable affair in some parts of the world, and that's, of course, part, as you know, of what the Muslim Brotherhood and its friends are all about. But in connection with specifically the degree to which the church itself is being targeted by these fellows, I wonder what you've discovered. I don't know if it's as manifest north of our border as it is south of it, but there's no question that some of the Christian faith are lending their personal prestige, their political cover, if you will, to these folks who are seeking to destroy us all from within, Christians among the first among them.
I think this is true. And what I try to do, I mean, the reason I call the book Heresy, one of the reasons is I just like provoking liberals. But it was to point out that liberal Protestants in particular are abandoning any form of Christianity, and they have abandoned their alleged brothers and sisters in Christ. I mean, as we speak now, in the Islamic world, Christians are being slaughtered. I've held in my hands a Bible soaked in the blood of Nigerian Christians killed by a Muslim gang. I've held in my hand bullets and nails used to kill Iraqi Christians in Baghdad, again, by Muslim gangs. And we have many liberal Protestants who really, they edit rather than follow Christ, who are more intent on appeasing and being liked by fanatical Muslims than actually standing out for Christians and Christianity. They've actually put themselves, I would argue, outside of the pale of orthodoxy now. They're no longer Christian. Mm.
They're not only Christians, they're certainly not going to be liked by fundamentalist Muslims either.
No, exactly. As much as Lenin was intrinsically evil, Lenin was a very clever man. These are useful idiots. His phrase about silly people in the West who thought communism might be fun, they're useful idiots. The Muslim Brotherhood, who learned quite a lot, actually, from socialism, as did Hitler, of course, they know this. And what they've done now is there's a new set of sacraments, a new theology, and that includes this idea of relativism. But even that's not true. It's not relativism. It's actually quite a penchant for Islam. Prince Charles, for example. Now, I'm not saying that Prince Charles is such a bad guy, but someone as ostensibly nice and cuddly as Prince Charles actually makes comments about Islam being such a wonderful faith and Muslims being model citizens. We should try living in his own country in the middle of Bradford or the middle of Blackburn or the middle of the East End of London and see what it's like. Yeah. Being an adulterer, for example.
He wouldn't last very long, would he?
He wouldn't last very long at all. But all over the Western world, the values and the virtues that we've held dear are under attack. And Christians, evangelicals, serious Catholics, are people who should be on the forefront of fighting back, too often are not doing enough, sometimes not even doing anything. And I even have to say in my own church, the Roman Catholic Church, I wish bishops would speak out more often and say, Islam is a challenge. It's not just the interpretation of Islam. It's the Quran itself. It's the laws that... Look, when Christians commit crimes, they do so in spite of Christian teaching. I've yet to be convinced that Muslims, when they commit crimes, do so in spite of Quranic teaching. I believe they often do it because of. Muhammad was a warlord. He did marry a child. That could never be said of Jesus. But you know what? Worst things are said about Christians. Another reason why I wrote the book, Bill Maher, John Stewart, they'll say these things constantly about Christians, but isn't it odd they don't say the same about Muslims?
Yeah. You know, having said that, Michael Corin, I was struck, I was in the preparation of this course, I came across a clip of Bill Maher saying pretty much what you just said about the Quran to Keith Ellison, member of Congress, Muslim, first Muslim, notorious in some circles for having sworn his oath of office upon a Quran, allegedly owned by Thomas Jefferson. And it was right, really quite bracing. You heard, of course, Keith Ellison engage in the classic taqiyya, as they call it, lying for the faith. But I was struck because I had not expected such a robust statement
I'm glad he did. A good for him. I wish he'd do it more often because when I was researching his book, I went through a lot of his work and there were the occasional comments about Islam, but they were outnumbered enormously by his attacks on
Yeah, well, I will send you this one, and I think it probably didn't go so well, and therefore he's dropped it. But very quickly, we've got less than a minute, but I just am struck, Michael Corin, you've written biographies about two of my favorite people, J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. They were both men who clearly understood the struggle between good and evil. This seems to me to be the subtext, really, of your book. Quick comment.
I'm flattered. I hope it is. I mean, I'm not as tall as either of those men, but I can stand on their shoulders. And Lewis, if anything, has influenced me a great deal to reemphasize in this confusing culture today that there is such a thing as right and wrong. And particularly people either don't understand that, or when they do understand it, they opt out. They decide not to get involved in this fight. And I'm afraid it's too late to not take sides.
There you go. We look forward to further visiting with you, if we may. Michael Corin, thank you very much for this important new book, Heresy, 10 Lies They Spread About Christianity, and for your courage in pointing out the double standard and the high stakes for all of us if we allow it to persist. We look forward to talking with you again very soon, sir.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey parents, finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, I'll fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you.
For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard.
Play frisbee in the park.
Ride a bike.
Kick the soccer ball around.
Or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
Because nothing makes you feel better than moving every day.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
So be a player.
You'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
Move it your way and be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
That's right, at letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
I'll pick you up after school. Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take a day for granted. You and your family are connected by routine, and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if your day's routine is disrupted and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit, make a plan, be informed today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined, I'm very pleased to say, on very short notice by Professor Barry Rubin. He is one of our go-to folks on developments in the Middle East and particularly in his home country of Israel. He is a professor at the Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya and director of the Gloria Center, as it's known, Global Research in International Affairs of the Interdisciplinary Center. Barry Rubin, there have been some seemingly tectonic shifts in the political arena of Israel overnight. Tell us what happened, and then we'll talk a little bit about what it might mean.
The two largest parties are Likud, headed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and Kadima, which has just changed leaders to Shaul Mufaz. And Netanyahu had chronic problems with his coalition. He's very, very personally popular, or another way to put it is that he met the situation of the time. I'll come back to that in a moment. But he had two headaches in his coalition, one with the small religious parties and one with one of his coalition partners, Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman, because of Lieberman's legal problems and general orneriness. So there have been like threats to force him to election. So he, in an absolutely brilliant maneuver, in fact, as colleague said to me, will go down in Israeli history as one of the most brilliant political maneuvers, he first called elections. He used to call, well, he didn't call elections. He used the threat of calling elections for leverage, and then he made a deal with the second largest party. He did so giving up amazingly little, and he also did so maintaining the maximum amount of support across the board. I mean, it can be argued that he controls over 90 of 120 Knesset seats, parliament seats. This is unprecedented. Now, I mean, I can explain it all. It depends how much time you have, but I'll just say one key element here is that Mufaz is coming to power in Kadima. Mufaz is a serious professional, retired general, and he understands the situation in the country, and he wants to be part of the leadership. And so he wanted to get into power. He has no personal friction or anything. And if, as we'll come to no doubt, Israel is going to at some point attack Iran, he wants to be in on that decision.
Yeah. Well, I do want to come to that.
Position of Deputy Prime Minister.
Deputy Prime Minister, okay. And is Lieberman still there as Foreign Minister with the baggage, or is that unclear?
give us a few more hours on that.
To sort it out.
That's really, the answer to that is, it's up to him. He has to make that decision. He's been thrown the defensive. And just one more point. The opposition now is the Labor Party, which has staked itself out not on international issues, but on social issues. So that's what they're going to be pressing on. So in other words, to put it in one sentence, in terms of international issues of all types, the country is more politically united today than it's been at almost any time in its history.
Yeah. So this is, from the perspective of those of us who are committed to the security of Israel and the ability of the Jewish state to provide for its own security, I gather, really a very signal improvement in the situation at a moment where it couldn't be arguably more needed.
I think it's really valuable, especially at this point in history, for a broader point to be made. Israel is a country because it has constant existential issues and it's under attack, both in armed terms and in verbal terms. Is a country where people have to face reality. They cannot have too much luxury of fantasizing about things. And when one looks at Europe and North America today, one sees societies in the grip of political and economic fantasies that are very self-damaging. And so up to a point, you can argue they can afford it, but I think that point has been reached. And that's why Israel, I think, is such an interesting model for other Western democracies. If you have huge threats, if you have huge potential economic problems, and Israel's done very well economically, you've got to pursue the policies of self-defense and of economic rationality in terms of the size of government and the spending of government and privatization versus nationalization that allow you to survive and prosper.
Yeah. Very
and that's
important
part of the lesson of this.
Yeah. We're speaking with Dr. Barry Rubin of the Gloria Center in Israel. He is the author most recently of Israel, An Introduction. And he is also a fellow who is deeply knowledgeable about another subject that I'd like to come to quickly, if I could, with you, Barry Rubin. Your book entitled Muslim Brotherhood, The Global Reach of the Islamist Movement, is very much on my mind. We have, as you may know, done recently a study of the Muslim Brotherhood in America at MuslimBrotherhoodInAmerica.com. And one of the things that jumps out at you is the rising aggressiveness of the Brotherhood elsewhere, as well as that of its front organizations here in the United States. Give us the latest, if you would, against the backdrop of this important sort of bracing up of the realists among those in power in Israel, of what's happening in Egypt at the moment as you see it, Barry Rubin.
Well, my view is that Egypt, not Iran, is actually the most immediate challenge to Israeli security. Now, if you get 75% of the vote in parliamentary elections, all the Islamists, if you are probably going to elect a president, if you have an ideology that's innately triumphalist, meaning God is on your side and victory is inevitable, And if you have a U.S. and the West that's not only too weak to oppose you, but in a sense arguably supports you, this is the kind of thing that's going to give people self-confidence, if not arrogance. Now, we are headed, people miss this point because they focus on the military in Egypt. I have never seen any sign at all, and I've said this for well over a year, that the military has any intention other than turning over power. And that turnover is coming very quickly because literally in the next 10 weeks, a president is going to be elected in Egypt, and the military junta, as far as I think, is going to dissolve and turn over power to that president and, of course, to that parliament. And the likelihood is that the president and parliament will be controlled and the Constitution will be written by radical Islamists who hate America and want to destroy it, certainly its position in the Middle East, who hate Israel and want to destroy it and talk about committing genocide, who want to fundamentally transform Egyptian society and make it into a Sharia state. These are like kind of serious issues. And the Western establishment is so blind to this, it defies, I mean, you can't compare this to the 1930s. You can't compare this to the immediate post-World War II period. And the first one, when a lot of people didn't want to recognize the threat of fascism, and the second, a lot of people didn't want to see the threat of communism. I'm not talking about the debate. I'm talking about people in power. That the willful blindness. Now, let me give you two small examples very quickly. One is there's a mantra that the Muslim Brotherhood has renounced violence. That's totally false. It renounced violence within Egypt to get to function. They support violence against the U.S. and Israel, and they say so every day. And secondly of all, that people are moderates when, in fact, in 80 to 90% of the speeches they make, they express radical points of view. So it's willful blindness. Is willfully blinding people to the fact that in about 10 weeks you're going to have a transformed Egypt, which is going to be hostile no matter what icing they put on the cake, and that the West is going to pretend that this isn't happening. It hasn't happened.
Well,
and that's a formula for disaster.
It is indeed, Barry Rubin. And to add to your point, the fact is that within the past month, the United States government has actually transferred $1.5 billion to the outgoing junta, as you call it, and presumably, therefore, to the incoming Muslim Brotherhood factions. And God help us if this money simply further reinforces and emboldens what is, I think you've rightly described, is a very dangerous group. And
the U.S. government is now talking about helping the Muslim Brotherhood establish businesses.
I have to let you go, Barry. We are completely out of time. I appreciate so much your joining us and the work you do at the Gloria Center. We look forward to working with you and to talking with you again in the near future. Thanks for this quick update on what's happening in Israel and in the region. Keep up the good work. We'll talk with you again soon. Next up, we'll get Andy McCarthy's take on what's happening with the trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and more. Straight ahead.
From a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medications, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call. And I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi. This is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a non-profit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Is Nancy Pelosi looking to a higher power to get a balanced budget? Hugh Hewitt sets her straight.
When I hear you speak about this issue, of course, it's the Gospel of Matthew. When I was hungry, you gave me to eat and listen.
I'm just going to stop here. Nancy Pelosi quoting the Gospel of Matthew, as though that's got anything to do with the government. Let me just tell you, it doesn't.
Can I get an amen?
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need, and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined as we have the high privilege of being most weeks by Andy McCarthy, the former federal prosecutor who has gone on to make innumerable other contributions besides putting away the blind shake in the public policy arena in his capacity as a contributing editor at Natural Review Online, as a author of important books like Willful Blindness and The Grand Jihad, and one I just learned the title of, a forthcoming book entitled Spring Fever. And Andy, we're looking forward to that with great expectation. I'm sure you're looking forward to getting the darn thing in print yourself. Welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank, and you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, a monkey off your back. Andy, speaking of monkeys on our back, we've got a spectacle playing out at the moment in Guantanamo Bay, where a military tribunal has begun the proceedings for the prosecution of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, a seriously bad guy, and several of his co-conspirators. We're all, I guess, of a mind, at least I hope we are, what a blessing it is they're not playing this theater of the absurd out in New York City in a civilian court. But what should we make of what happened over the weekend and what you think is coming next in that prosecution?
Well, it was something of a circus over the weekend, Frank, as I think we should expect it will be. Eyes are following is to try to have the process kind of collapse of its own weight. I think, and when I say its own weight, I mean of all the procedural protections that are built in for defendants in a, whether it's the military justice system or the civilian justice system. And I should point out to people that it would be no less of a circus in the civilian system. In many ways, the military has more ways to deal with this, I think, than a civilian judge might. But, you know, our system assumes that the defendants who are in it are exploiting their rights for the purpose of, you know, for a proper purpose in the system, which is to put the government to its proof. That assumption doesn't work with people who are trying to discredit the integrity of the system and whose objective is to try to turn the thing into a farce so that justice cannot be done. So in a sense, we're, you know, we're really challenging ourselves here because we're trying to give, for whatever reason, a fair trial with a lot of integrity to barbarians who just want to turn it into a circus.
Right. It seems as though this is of a piece, then, Andy McCarthy, as you have documented in countless articles and in your books, with the kind of disconnect between how this enemy is waging war against us and how we are trying to comport ourselves, both in the kinetic phases of the war and in the non-kinetic phases of the war. We've had the Obama administration, I think, since we last talked, Andy, saying through at least an unnamed senior State Department figure that the war on terror is over, and then John Brennan, the Homeland Security Advisor, saying, well, not completely. But both of those assertions seem to suggest that we are still really willfully blind about the nature of this enemy and therefore susceptible to reverses, not just in the courtroom, but in the battlefields, both kinetic and non-kinetic.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it, Frank. I mean, to be honest, I've myself been known from time to time to say that the war is over, but I think I mean by it something very different than
in the worst sense of the word.
Yes, exactly. You know, when the enemy is still fighting it, and you know our side stops treating it like a war, I think you know that's a big problem. But you know the thing about terrorists, and I think you could say this about all manner of savages, because the Nazi example springs to mind as well, is they really do challenge your basic assumptions about what fundamental fairness is and what you owe to people who violate the law, when what you're talking about is violating the law of nature almost more than man's law. I mean, to be a little more concrete about it, at the time of Nuremberg, Churchill thought it was a terrible mistake to give a trial to the Nazis. He just basically thought they should be shot at sunrise, that they ought to be treated like they used to treat pirates, which is the yardarm, not a bells and whistles trial. And in a lot of ways, I think Churchill had a lot of wisdom in this. And the point was, never give a trial to people who you are not willing to release if the trial goes their way. So we're dealing here, I think, with people that we will never, ever release, no matter how the trial goes, because that's how atrocious they are. And yet we're trying to, that makes us feel good about, getting to a result that's been proved in a courtroom type quantum of proof. There's a little bit of contradiction in that.
Well, Andy, this is a fascinating point. And again, we're speaking with Andy McCarthy of National View Online and author of Willful Blindness and the Grand Jihad and Spring Fever, the forthcoming book about the so-called Arab Spring. We have been told by the Obama administration, even when it was still fairly critical of the Bush administration, whose policies it's in substantial degree decided to continue, that there were people who were detained at Guantanamo Bay who fit into that category, who we will never release, and we simply can't try. What is it about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed that put him in this category that we thought we could try? Is it the conviction, to use the sense of the word I mean, that we will actually secure a conviction? It's just dead to rights, or that he pled guilty, in effect, earlier on? Or what is it that's going on here? Because, as you say, we can't afford to let such a guy go.
No, that's right. Well, you know, it's a tough question to answer, Frank, without knowing exactly what their evidence is. But we do know that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was indicted by a grand jury in New York years before 9/11 ever happened. So somewhere in the bowels of the Justice Department, and more likely the bowels of my old office, the U.S. Attorney's Office of the Southern District of New York, which returned that indictment, or where that indictment was returned, there was obviously a pretty strong belief that, at least with respect to some of the early terrorism of the 1990s, there was more than enough evidence to convict Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been indicted, and that's evidence that would be admissible in a trial. Now, as far as 9/11 is concerned, again, you know, we'd have to see what proof they have that they think they can get in besides coerced statements, which they say they're not going to use. And the one example we have for this is the Massawi trial, the Zacharias Massawi, the guy who was, I think, incorrectly alleged to be the 20th hijacker at certain points. We actually know who the 20th hijacker was, and it wasn't Massawi. But the interesting thing about the Massawi case is Massawi defied the advice he was getting from almost everyone and actually pled guilty. And as a result, waived all of the things that he said were, or his lawyer said were procedural violations, including that he couldn't get access to evidence that he said, including witnesses like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, that he said was necessary for presenting his defense. And when his claims were evaluated on appeal, they said to him, you know, you may have a point here. You may very well have gotten an unfair trial, but by pleading guilty, the law is that you've waived your right to complain about all of that. So we never really teed up the question in the Maselli case, which I think begs for an answer, and that is, you know, can you do these trials with all this sort of very sensitive, classified information under the strictures that are imposed in the civilian court system, many of which are actually also imposed on the military court system?
Yeah. Well, this is a pregnant question, as they say, Andy McCarthy, and we will have to wait to see it gestate a bit further. We will be evaluating it with your sonograms, if I may continue the metaphor, for some time to come, I suspect. Thanks so much for joining us today, Andy, as always, and for your insights and for the work that you do at National Review Online and so many other parts of the battle space of what I call the war for the free world. Keep it up. We'll talk with you again next week, and we will talk, I hope, with the rest of you tomorrow, same time. Same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.